Welcome to Rejected Religion Spotlight. Today's guest is my friend and colleague, Thomas von Breda. Thomas has been a guest on the podcast in the past, talking about Aleister Crowley, and also as a guest of a roundtable episode where we talked about the strange phenomenon surrounding the documentary series Hellier. But today, he's a guest on Spotlight. So welcome, Thomas.
Thank you so much for inviting me again. Always a pleasure, always an honor. I love Rejected Religion.
Thank you so much. I so appreciate the support. Okay, so today you are going to talk today about Dion Fortune. And you have written about Dion Fortune in your research master thesis with regard to the concept of initiation. But before we get into all of that, for the sake of those who may not know too much about Dion Fortune herself, who she was, what she did, can you first begin with a little bit of a background or bio about her, how she came into contact with esoteric orders, magical orders like the Hermetic Order of the Golden Dawn, among other esoteric groups, so that we kind of have a foundation of where we're going.
Sure. First of all, I have to give a shout out to the member, to the user who requested this, because this was a viewer request,
oh, yeah,
right?
That's right. Yes, very good of you. Very attentive of you. Yes, thank you.
Well, it was so fun. It was so sweet. So I hope I don't mess this up.
I'm sure you won't.
Well, there's a bit of an issue that I have to address first, which is how to tell Dion Fortune's story. There are biographies published about her, which you can easily find online. Problem is they don't match. So if you just read like the Wikipedia page of Dion Fortune, you might notice it. The biography sometimes references made to one author who says one thing, but then it's clarified that in another biography, this doesn't match and there's another claim. So this has been kind of a problem. So for anyone who is interested in reading more about Dion Fortune, I kind of recommend reading all biographies or more, or just to keep it in mind that you need to take certain things with a grain of salt. And if you happen to have access to academic sources, I highly recommend Susan Johnston Graff's research on Dion Fortune, especially Talking to the Gods. That's a monograph that has a brilliant biographical reconstruction using all the different sources available. So that's the one I will be using. So this might miss some details that people might be familiar with, but this is like the exoteric, confirmable version of Dion Fortune's story.
Duly Fortune noted. Was,
yeah, well, you know, it's my job to say these annoying things.
Right.
Fortune was actually born not Dion Fortune. She was born Violet Mary Firth in Wales, 1890, into a middle-class family of, not unimportantly, Christian Scientists. So that, I guess, would be her first connection to spirituality. So for those who don't know what that is, Christian Science is really a new religious movement, which started in the 19th century, which simplistically put claimed that Christian prayer was kind of like the ultimate and really only appropriate medicine for all kinds of medical illnesses, all kinds of material misfortunes. So it's rather notorious for some of its adherents refusing medical care, even in emergency situations. That's not like a dogma in Christian Science, but that's probably how you know it, if you know it. So that's kind of her spiritual background. We don't really know how pervasive this was. We know her mother was deeply interested in Christian Science. Her father, we don't know as much. So keep that in mind. That might be interesting to know. The first relevant, I would say, biographical event for this spotlight episode is her well-known claim of being psychically attacked at about 23 years of age in 1913. If you're interested for details, see Fortune's Psychic Self-Defense. That's a book she wrote. From a non-occultist standpoint, I guess we could say she suffered a nervous breakdown after a toxic relationship. In any case, it resulted in years-long intense fatigue and anxiety, which she reports only ceased when she became initiated into the Golden Dawn. So interesting. More about that later, I guess. Okay. In any case, the psychic attack slash nervous breakdown was a massive turning point in her life because it inspired her to take up a study of psychology and psychoanalysis. So Fortune is very much known for her psychological background, her psychological theories mixed in with her occultist stuff, so to speak. So that's where she started. There's a lot of confusing claims about where and how Fortune studied psychology. So be careful with that when you read biographies. Very completely different stories. In any case, we can say it's pretty clear she was not professionally trained. She didn't have a degree or anything. She was most likely a well-read amateur psychologist, we could say. And her conclusion at this time was that psychology was right about the deep unconscious origins of the human mind and the way it worked, but that psychological methods or psychoanalytical or psychotherapeutic methods were too limited in scope, and that conventional therapy couldn't reach those deep unconscious origins that Fortune was so interested in, and that occultism could. So it's interesting that Fortune moved from psychology to occultism. Even though she was very heavily influenced by psychological theory, she ended up concluding that psychological practice was simply not enough. So she started looking at other spiritual traditions that had more answers for her. So in the beginning, that was theosophy. She also joined a country commune called The Grange, which was a Gurdjieff-like community, which challenged its members to abandon their ego and their egoic attachments and other elements of their false selves to gain access to a higher manifestation of individuality. Sadly, we don't know a lot about that. More importantly, she met her first occult teacher shortly afterwards, Theodore Moriarty. We also don't know a lot about him, so that's typical Fortune. We have like little nuggets, but it's so hard to have details, but that's what we can reconstruct. He famously appeared in fictional form as Dr. Taverner in Fortune's fictional work, The Secrets of Dr. Taverner. Moriarty ran his own occult lodge in Hammersmith, of which Fortune was a member. Sadly, we don't know when she joined or left, but we do have one document that shows she was a member in 1919, which is also the year she joined the Golden Dawn. So that's what we can reconstruct. It's not a lot, but or actually maybe it is compared to other figures. So the Golden Dawn, I mean, I talked about it, but I guess I should quickly just mention it was an organization founded in 1887. It offered its members a system of theoretical and practical training in the occult arts. It compiled together practices of ritual magic, initiation ritual inspired by Freemasonry, astrology, astral traveling, geomancy, tarot divination. It was truly this magical school which presented itself as offering a complete and thorough instruction in all the branches of magical learning of ages past. When she joined, however, the Golden Dawn had been basically ripped to shreds during a notorious schism as the result of internal quarrels about spiritual authority, details of which I will not go into right now. The result in any case is that by the time Fortune joined the Golden Dawn, it split up into three competing factions. But, and this has been important for Fortune fans, Fortune joined the original one, the Alpha et Omega faction in London. So Fortune is often next to Aleister Crowley mentioned as an example of a true Golden Dawn occultist, Golden Dawn author, because she had a legitimate historical connection to the real Golden Dawn, so to speak. And in this order, she claimed the motto Deo non fortuna, which is possibly a family motto from her grandfather, I believe. In any case, it means God not luck or God not fortune, which led to her famous writing name, Dion Fortune. And like I said, Fortune claimed that the initiation finally purified her aura that had supposedly been defiled or blocked by her psychic attack 6 years prior. So that definitely sealed Fortune's belief that initiation had real tangible effects when properly done. So that's probably been an extremely important spiritual experience for her to realize that initiation was, she compares it to a vaccine actually, which is interesting, kind of relevant right now. She says it's like vaccination. It, if it works, it, it shows an unmistakable reaction, which is immediate and incontestable. So that's interesting.
Yes.
So she experienced that herself. 3 years later already, Fortune was already given permission to found her own small little lodge that would introduce new members to the Alpha and Omega and assist in some provisional training. So this is typical of Fortune. She was a very confident woman who inspired a lot of, how would you say, she was so confident, sounded so authoritative that people sort of naturally flocked towards her as an authority that would also kind of get her in trouble. But my point, I guess, is that when she joined the Golden Dawn, she was already a force to be reckoned with. She also had her own thoughts. She had her own unique background with psychology. As I'll mention later, probably she had her own spiritual contacts that she could fall back on. So she wasn't necessarily a newbie, but the Golden Dawn became definitely the theoretical foundation for her occult writings. So, and she admitted that for the rest of her life. So she might not have been super happy with the state of the Golden Dawn, but the system was inviolate, as she would say, and was essential for anyone who was interested in a Western magical practice.
All right. Well, that's very interesting. At a certain point, though, Fortune decided to leave the Golden Dawn. Will you talk more about the reasons for this break with the group and also her later views about such organizations? Because there's a lot to be said about this.
Yes, absolutely. So like I said, this is probably not the time to mention it, to elaborate on it. But like I said, Fortune had her own spiritual contacts. She wasn't just relying on the Golden Dawn for her spiritual experiences. She had her own private link with the spiritual world, I guess you could say. And it's this division of allegiance that definitely led to her break with the order, because she was just kind of doing something else, spiritually speaking. So it's, the details aren't clear. Again, there are many different versions. What is commonly claimed is that the event that started the problems was probably the publication of a book of hers, her first nonfiction work as an occultist. The Esoteric Philosophy of Love and Marriage was published in 1924, which reportedly Moina Mathers, the wife of one of the original Golden Dawn founders and then head of the lodge she was part in, claimed was a breach of order secrecy, because it revealed materials that was part of the inner order teachings. And, you know, she had no business revealing that because she had sworn an oath. Fortune would later claim that she didn't even have the grade. She didn't even have the degree wherein that information would be unveiled. So that was probably a very disappointing experience for her, because she definitely didn't feel like she did anything wrong. And like I said, it's possible she didn't even get the information she revealed from the Golden Dawn. So it leads to this big claim that Moina started attacking her on the astral plane. So it's a bit of a drama and a bit of a mystery. But in 1927, she either left the order based on mutual understanding that she just had her own spiritual path. That's one story. The other story is that, you know, she was attacked and expelled. So Fortune simply joined another organization. So that's kind of Fortune's pragmatic touch, I guess. She eventually founded her own order. She was affiliated with the Theosophical Society in multiple ways. So Fortune definitely didn't seem to think that there was only one organization out there or anything. So that's interesting. Fortune never seems to have joined the Golden Dawn as, for example, Aleister Crowley did, like, ooh, this is going to give me all of the answers I'm looking for. Fortune was already kind of like on her own path. And even though she later joined the Theosophical Society, she always tried to change things. She was a bit of a rebel in that sense. She identified as a rebel as well, as a kind of a revealer of teachings she felt were unjustly guarded with a veil of secrecy. She compares herself positively to Israel Regardi and Aleister Crowley as part of this trio, this sort of bad rebel trio of people who kind of called out occultists on their SHIT kind of like stop with all the mysterious mystery mongering and the secrecy. And there's a lot more we can say and should publish. And we're not just gonna keep our ridiculous secrecy oaths because they're insane and they're not based on reason. So it's interesting that Fortune has that kind of energy around her. And you can tell if you read her work, she has her own opinion on things. She has her own mind on things. And she doesn't really ever promote a certain organization or anything. She promotes her own ideas. Mm-hmm. I only found out she joined the Theosophical Society, for example, years after I already read all of her books. So it doesn't really impact her writing style. I always found that pretty interesting. Mm. Her own organization still exists, by the way. It's called the Society of the Inner Light. It was originally called the Fraternity of the Inner Light. The origin of this is extremely difficult to piece together. Check out Susan Johnston's research for this. Seems safe to say that this group originated out of the miniature lodge that was affiliated with the Golden Dawn that I talked about. It apparently started seriously coming together around 1928 or something. As for her views on occultist orders in general, she wasn't very flattering. she was probably not the person you would read or enjoy reading if you were an order fanatic. For example, she published a piece in the Occult Review, which was a periodical, in 1934, called Occultism from the Inside. So again, that gives you an idea of how Fortune liked to present herself as this, I'm an insider and I'm going to say some stuff, right? And in typical Fortune style, she writes, occult orders are bunkum. They're nuts. You probably shouldn't join them. And Fortune sort of stuck with that. She has multiple reasons for that. For example, the Golden Dawn was kind of already in ruins when she joined. Fortune always distinguishes the system orders work with and the actual members of the order who are probably going to ruin it. Fortune definitely doesn't believe that occult orders can last very long because human psychology is kind of crap and ruins the pure spiritual energies in time. And therefore, it's important for Fortune to have your own spiritual contacts that are not necessarily related to an organization. Because when you join an organization, you enter the group mind of the organization. And sadly, there's just manipulative people out there who will abuse you. And Fortune, of course, with the background of her own psychic attacks, possibly, that's something she was very passionate about sharing. Like, don't just join an organization. Be really careful. Be skeptical. Be critical. She gives you Insane Occultism, I believe, which is again, typical title for Fortune. Like, sane occultism, not regular occultism. The intellectual kind or something. It's fascinating work. And she gives like a list of tips, like what do you need to look out for when you join an organization, when you meet a spiritual teacher, what are the characteristics you need to look out for to make sure that this person isn't going to mess with you or going to treat you in a toxic way. So that's kind of unique. Not a lot of occultists write about that. So again, that's part of her psychological background. It's part of her personal experience, that constant sense of people are dangerous, so be careful. And you're dealing with very subtle energies, so you need to be really careful. I guess for a lot of readers today, she kind of sounds too careful. Fortune is very reticent about giving magical practices. She describes them very vaguely because there's this constant sense that I can't say too much because people can hurt themselves with this information. So even though she liked to play the role of the revealer, it didn't really end up as spectacularly as, say, Aleister Crowley, because she was very concerned. She was very worried. It's kind of touching in a way, maybe also kind of elitist, depends on your interpretation. In any case, Fortune also really disliked, like I said, the secrecy surrounding occultist orders. So she was always proud to divulge information that occultist orders would probably like to keep for themselves. So yeah, I guess we'll come back to it a little bit later when we're talking about her own spiritual contact, but I don't remember which book it was, but there's a certain book where Fortune literally says, claim your initiation from the masters, not from any occult order. So even though she found her own initiation very helpful on a psychic level, towards the end of her life, she definitely seems to have been convinced that that probably shouldn't be your first entry into spirituality. You should probably meditate first, try to find contacts. That's classic Fortune, as I will explain. You need to have a firm ground in the on the inner plane, so to speak, before you try to affiliate yourself with any organization, because it will probably end up a disappointment and possibly dangerous. So that kind of sums up the kind of warning and unattractive opinion Fortune had on occultist orders, which I guess many people are like, hell yeah, I mean, let's join.
Yeah.
I'm going to learn stuff, but Fortune immediately would be like, you might want to do some preparatory training and learn about psychology as well, because you will need to know about group minds, about group influences, because you will really be exposing yourself on a massive level, not just physically, emotionally, spiritually, and you need to be prepared for that because you are, you're putting yourself out in the open, so...
That's very interesting about the contradiction between not wanting to keep secrets, but then wanting to keep secrets. And also this, actually, it seems like she is promoting like self-teaching, I guess, in the beginning. But to me, that seems a bit, I mean, I don't know what the situation was at that time with regards to literature, or other sources where people can go to find, in her opinion, what in her opinion would be the true material, the true teachings. So there seems to be a bit of a tension there. Like if you don't know anything about it, how are you supposed to be able to do the work ahead of time to know and to recognize when you're trying to be or when you're attempting, you know, to learn things that other people are attempting to trick you or to manipulate you or abuse you or attack you or anything like that. So she seems to have figured it out in her own mind, but did she try to explain this in more detail to others as to how it is you're supposed to go about doing this preparatory work?
She did and she didn't. You know, she gives... the most elaborate theoretical preparatory like training outline I've seen from like any occultist. I believe it's it's something like initiates and it has the word training in it. Training of the initiates or something.
Okay.
I can't believe I forgot. But she that's one book where she gives you an idea of what you need to do before you can even think of becoming an occultist. And it is wild. It is like you need to be updated on all contemporary philosophy and ancient philosophy. You need to know mathematics. You need to know basics of natural science. You need to know psychology. You need to know mythology. When I read that book for the first time, I just could not believe how serious she was about this compared to just do a ritual,
right?
You know, absolutely not. For Fortune, that was the last thing you should try. So, and this kind of ties into her views on initiation. For her, it was very, very, very serious. You're not just doing this for yourself. You are performing a service to the entire universe, and you become a chain in a link that has been formed throughout creation. So Fortune doesn't really care about what you want to get out of it. You need to become, I have my thesis here, and there's this quote I always like to read because it's just a little bit different. It sums up kind of her attitude towards the attitude you should have as a would-be initiate. Right. I quote here, "The masters receive souls as pupils, not for the benefit of the soul, but for the benefit of the great work. A man is not trained for the sake of his curiosity or enthusiasm, but only insofar as he is of value as a servant." So again, that's not really language you hear a lot in occultist ritual writings, for her, it's really about, you know, you need to be ready, and you can't decide when you're going to be ready. The spiritual masters decide, and when you're ready, something will happen, but you're not in control. And all she really offers in terms of practical suggestions is meditation. The closest she gets to is, yeah, I'm not going to show the front because there's a tear in it, but it's the mystical Kabbalah. Mm-hmm. Very subtly, she offers tips for meditation on the Tree of Life, but it's not even explicit. You really have to figure it all out on your own. And I guess for Fortune, that's kind of a test as well. You know, if you can't figure out your own study plan, you don't even have the, you don't have the motivation, you don't have the self-discipline. So Fortune was a strict teacher, I guess, mm-hmm. in that sense. If yeah. you weren't ready, nothing would happen. And you don't even consider performing anything, performing any ritual, because your character needs to be ready to serve. And that's not an attitude most people have when they join, when they think, oh, you know, I'm just performing some magical rituals. Fun.
Yeah.
Absolutely not what Fortune's thinking of.
And it seems to go greatly against the idea that Crowley put forth about, you know, your will and, you know, your autonomy and all of this. So, yeah, it's very, very different. But do you think that had something to do with this idea of being a servant to the masters? Had something to do with her own past, that, you know, she felt that she was psychically inclined, that she just had these gifts that she had to use because that was what she was supposed to do, that the masters told her that she needed to use these gifts?
Right. I guess I should talk a bit about how Fortune talks about initiation in general.
Let's just move on then to initiation, because we're kind of skirting around this whole topic. Let's just get into it.
Right.
She had very specific ideas about initiation that differed from the hierarchy of knowledge levels that you find in other groups such as Golden Dawn. So please expand more on all of this.
All right. First of all, we see a very heavy theosophical influence regarding initiation and evolution. So this is kind of present in the Golden Dawn, but Fortune, maybe through Moriarty, clearly she just references theosophical ideas a lot more. So initiation isn't just like a ritual you do in an organization to pass from one grade to the next. It is a natural process of evolution. It is constantly happening all around us. And it's actually kind of similar to Crowley. Not a lot of people know this, but Crowley also presented initiation as a natural process, as something that even happens on a molecular level, like cells are constantly becoming initiated. So you're tapping into it. And then the natural process moves faster. So it's all tied to this idea of evolution, which really starts impacting esoteric literature in the 19th century. And supposedly the goal of all of this evolution is to lead all of material existence back to a spiritual origin. So again, it's not about you. No one cares about the powers you want to achieve in your order. No. This is a cosmic process, and you need to become part of that process. That's the right-hand path. If you want to do magic on your own, you become like a black magician almost. Fortune uses that terminology very heavily. There's a left-hand path and a right-hand path. Mm-hmm. There's a path of service and a path of egoic attachment, I guess, like I said earlier.
And the left-hand path is the path of the ego, in her opinion?
Okay. Yeah. So Fortune uses all of these kinds of fantastical historical lineages of initiation traced through bygone eras. She talks about that very problematic concept of theosophy, root races, always very fun. So if you're interested in reading Fortune, kind of be prepared racially, in terms of sexual orientation, very conservative. She didn't stand out. This was just sadly part of the culture back then. But yes, she does think that every continent has their own special initiatory goal. Obviously very kind of an uncomfortable idea now, but mm-hmm. yeah, she also talks about Atlantis, Lemuria, the Elder Brethren. So it's this entire pseudo-historical amalgamation of theosophy-inspired mythology. can be interesting. If you're interested in that, see her book Esoteric Orders and Their Work, published in 1928. That's a whole book about that. Curious thing is, however, Fortune uses different stories of how initiation emerged, how it developed in each one of her books. So she just kind of switches between narratives, which I find very interesting. That kind of became the basis for my research on her. But the basic point is always that initiation is a cosmic process that is at work at all time. And this is crucial, is not in some kind of secret possession of one organization or another. So occult schools have to tap into this process themselves. And when they lose that connection, they can't initiate anymore. So I say this is crucial because this becomes the basis upon which Fortune can say, you don't like me, I'll just join another order, because they can tap into the same process. You're not necessarily offering anything unique here. And I can come up with my own occult school. I can, if I have the talent, I can tap into those sources myself. So this is something that starts to happen in the beginning of the 20th century, when occultists start claiming their own initiatory contacts, just like the Golden Dawn did. So that's why you get so many different orders all of a sudden, instead of this one big pinnacle that was supposed to offer everything. And Fortune was definitely one of the first ones to get that. Like, oh, I can just claim my own initiatory channel. And therefore I'm never completely affiliated with one or the other order. So that's important for her. On a personal level, the ultimate goal of initiation is the complete surrendering of individual consciousness and a cosmic union with the divine mind. So fairly typical theme of esoteric literature. But again, the values of servitude and devotion are really marked in Fortune. You're really completely surrendering everything. And this is an attitude Fortune says is crucial if you want to really advance spiritually. You have to mentally accept that you will have to sacrifice everything, your career, your friends, your loved ones, any earthly attachments. So this is possibly like a residue from the Grange, that Gurdjieff like community possibly, because this is something Fortune really stresses. If you have any material attachments, the masters will take them away from you until you completely surrender. So again, intense. Fortune's intense. So not everyone would be attracted to this kind of idea, I guess. Like, oh, I just have to completely strip myself of all individuality because that's the only way I can serve. That's what Fortune's saying. So according to Fortune, every one of us can contact these masters, very exalted types of being that have evolved past the need to incarnate and which guide the evolution of mankind communally. So she goes as far as saying quite uniquely that until one has made contact with such a master specifically on the inner planes, the student will never find authoritative spiritual instruction on earth as well. So that contact with the inner planes seals the progress on planet Earth. So the student is then automatically guided to an occult teacher or a school that is right for that individual. So there's really no point, if you take her literally, to try to find your own spiritual teacher or school. You will always have to find your own unique master, which will have, at the end of the day, the full responsibility over your spiritual training, not an occult school. This is kind of a unique idea. I haven't really found this in other occultist writers, the way she presents it. Like, you really need to start by trying to contact these masters. This is actually the reason Israel Lagardi criticized her, and many occultists criticized her, because this picking up contacts, channeling masters, it's not really a topic occultist ritual magicians talk about. And many people, including Israel Lagardi, who's probably now kind of like one of the biggest authorities on 20th century style magic. He said that this has nothing to do with magic. This is something completely different. Picking up contacts, skip that. It's totally unnecessary. Fortune claimed it was crucial. So there you see, these figures are very close together, all trained at the Golden Dawn, but Fortune had her very own specific ideas. And you're right. That brings me to her own initiation, which, surprise, was exactly in line with what she presented was the right initiation process for everyone else. So her own ideas on initiation are clearly rooted in her own quite special experience. It must have been somewhere between 1918 and 1922. Fortune read a theosophical book, The Ancient Wisdom by Annie Besant, 1897 book. It's not important right now what the book is, because Fortune herself claimed she was just randomly reading through it. And she read a particular passage about the Brotherhood of the Great White Lodge and a hierarchy of adepts governing man's evolution. And Fortune claims that upon reading this passage, she felt her higher self, term she uses, suddenly wake up, forming a, I quote, one-pointed desire to find these masters. And this part I definitely need to quote, because this is typical dramatic, serious Fortune. This is from the Cosmic Doctrine. Fierce as thwarted love and stronger than the fear of death was that desire, and there was no price I was not willing to pay. If you don't have that attitude, then you're not getting it. So that's the energy Fortune wants you to have. And she said she stayed in this contemplative state, she calls it, for 10 days. Her mind constantly focused on finding these masters from waking till sleeping, which again, she says, that's how you do it. It's not about doing rituals. It's not about performing special meditations in the beginning. It's about that one-pointed desire that unlocks the door to the spiritual world. And on the night of the 10th day, almost like a fairy tale, she had a dream vision. She distinguishes dream from vision here. So she dreamed, and then the dream turned into a vision very spectacularly. I hope like Marvel pays attention, because it's like a beautiful vision of a library opening up into another space. And it opens up to the Himalayas, where she meets two masters, one of them being the Master Jesus, which would feature quite heavily in Fortune's writings. I guess this is the part where I have to point out, it's not necessarily the stereotypical Christian Jesus. She talks about the Christ force, which is kind of related to Christianity, but Fortune's constantly bashing the church. So please don't think now that Fortune was some kind of closeted Christian. But she did believe that Christ force was a real specific thing. So she met, that was going to be her master. So there were two of them present. She said, interestingly, I felt more attracted to the other one because he was more intellectual and more fierce. And I felt like I could learn more stuff from him. And Jesus was so boring and compassionate and slow. And I don't want to have to deal with him, but yeah, Master Jesus was the one. And later, of course, she said, that was my master. At the time, I couldn't understand it, but that was the one that I had to have. And then she woke up from this vision and had an unshakable inner conviction that she had been initiated, and slowly regained all memory of her past incarnations, which were apparently filled with spiritual practice for hundreds and hundreds of years. She calls it temple work. And that's interesting because, and this is something that always fascinated me, she claimed she regained the entirety of all of the theoretical and practical teachings she had acquired in all of these incarnations, just like that. So I quote again from the Cosmic Doctrine, I have never had to work for my knowledge of occultism, but have recovered it, not even piecemeal, but in the mass from memory. So that's how she was already a member of the Golden Dawn then, but that must have been massive. Like, oh, suddenly she went from like kind of a bit of an exploring student to, oh, I now have the knowledge of like 20 incarnations of occultist temple work. At least that's what she claimed. That's kind of spectacular.
Yeah, this was not something that other occultists would be claiming. Not other members of the Golden Dawn wouldn't be making claims like this. I don't know, this is silly, but it reminds me of The Matrix when Neo gets everything downloaded, all the martial arts.
Yeah.
I know Kung Fu.
Yeah, maybe she woke up like that. Yeah.
I'm sorry. I'm not trying to make a mockery of this, not at all. But it does, it just made me think of that scene where he just knew everything all of a sudden.
Yeah. That's how she presents it.
Well, and I guess you could call it a gnosis in a way.
Yeah, absolutely.
But in a sense that it's not, I guess it's not gnosis because it's something that she had already learned that she was just remembering, right?
And it was also theoretical and practical stuff. So that's quite unusual.
That is different.
Again, channel. So
yeah,
kind of an alternative technique. So her occultist colleagues would have no problem saying, I don't know what you channeled, but that's not occultist teaching. That's different. What you've channeled is different. And this probably led to Fortune kind of just ending up creating her own order, because what she was channeling and this master contact remained for the rest of her life was different from the stuff that she was learning in the Golden Dawn and theosophy as well. So that personal contact changed everything for her. So that's very important to know if you're starting to read her books. It's really coming from all different kinds of sources, but most importantly, her own not incarnated master on the inner planes. Interestingly, and I do want to emphasize this, she does understand that this vision of the masters on the Himalayas was not how it actually happened. She admits in the same work, The Cosmic Doctrine, that it was extremely colored through her own imagination. In fact, one of the hallmarks of Fortune's occultist teachings is that any visual content at all during spiritual visions is never objective, ever. It only represents higher spiritual truths, which are always perceived in abstract form. So I found that interesting. That was the first time I think I read an occultist say that, that the higher up you go, the less you see, the more abstract things become. So with her insight of psychology, she quickly made the step to saying that if you are experiencing visual content, you should always keep it in the back of your mind that your unconscious contents are playing a massive role in shaping that experience. So do not believe you're actually on the Himalayas meeting the Master Jesus, because you're not. You're engaging with forces and energies that your mind simply cannot comprehend yet in a proper form, because you're human. So this is why I'm fascinated by Fortune, because she did write that book about all of these Atlantis and Lemuria and the Elder Brethren, and she does describe these masters. But then it's never clear how serious we should take it as readers. So is it colored through Fortune's imagination, or does she correctly channel everything? So you're kind of lost in the woods there a little bit when Fortune talks about this kind of stuff. But Fortune does drop these hints consistently that if you take it literally, you're completely off path. Should always keep in mind that at the end of the day, it's never going to be visual. It's never going to be you meeting a master on the inner planes. That's all temporary preparation. She likens all of that occultist training as a mathematical tool that helps you think on the abstract planes using symbols, using visuals, but it's something you discard once you can operate on these abstract realms. So yeah. So always keep that in mind.
Okay. So this, all of these things that are happening, these are subjective experiences that your consciousness is just filling in the gaps.
Right. And there might be an objective core to it, but in the beginning stages, you probably wouldn't know what's subjective, what's subjective. Right. And this idea kind of lived in the Golden Dawn already. Like, how do you check astral visions? How do you make sure that what you're seeing is real? But because Fortune has such an intense background in psychology, she was like 100 times more aware of that and interested in talking about that. So in Sane Occultism, for example, she gives endless techniques for example, how to make sure that your past life memories are really past life memories. And it's always kind of confusing to me, because then on the next page, she'll say that past life memories are also like kind of illusory because time and space don't exist on the spiritual realms. But then you do have past incarnations, even though time and space don't exist. So it's constantly
how do you reconcile that? Yeah.
Yeah. Well, so it's the same.
Okay. But if you're thinking in terms of, you know, there is no time. There probably is a space, but there's no time. And you're in a human body living in, you know, on Earth that has the, you know, you're using the concept of time. I mean, you have to use the words that people would understand. People don't understand not functioning in time. Right. Because that's what we're in it. We're conditioned to think in those terms. I have to think about
exactly.
I have to think about all the hyperstition stuff now about, you know, time theory of memory and time and Bergson and Deleuze and all of that stuff. I was just thinking about all of that recently.
Sure.
In Fortune's system, I guess, is what happened to her, that everything happened spontaneously and immediately, that she knew things, all of these things at once. Was that how everyone was supposed to be able to experience
If you had all of those incarnations of temple work, that's the kicker. So that's the disappointment as a reader, I guess. That all depends on what you've done in your past lives. Mm. So she was able to recover all of that because she already learned it. But if you're just starting out, you will have to start from the absolute beginning, and you will probably not recover anything, because this might be your first incarnation that you're even interested in spirituality. Okay. So that's kind of a bummer.
So it's not the same for everyone.
No.
Okay.
That came in real handy for her, obviously.
Yeah. And it just makes me think of what Karen Swartz was talking about, how Rudolf Steiner, had all of these ideas and claims that, you know, you could do all of these things and achieve all of these states, but he was the only one that did it. Nobody else did it. So in this example, are there any other people who were following Dion Fortune's system that made these claims that you know of? That said that they had the same type of experience that she did, of just immediately knowing or remembering, I guess you could say.
No, honestly, no.
No.
Obviously, she did have her own school. Mm-hmm. But I guess, yeah, it's all centered on your master knows what you need. So it all depends on that personal relationship with the master. And it's perfectly possible that Fortune regained, I mean, that's kind of what she's implying. Fortune regained all of that knowledge because that's not what she had to do anymore. Like she said, I was attracted to that master of knowledge, but I got the master Jesus because I needed to work on my empathy and I need to work on my leadership and emotional capabilities. So it might also depend on that. It's not necessarily that you're ahead because you regain all of this knowledge, because in Fortune's system, your integrity and your emotional constitution and your a lack of sexual blockage, and there were a lot more things that go into being an initiate than just knowing how to do a ritual. So yeah, that's okay. Also an interesting nuance, I guess.
If we can loop back to the whole thing about the magic and the rituals, you said something that, if you can help me remember, that Israel Regardi said something about what Dion Fortune was claiming wasn't magic. Can you talk about that again? Just refresh my memory, because I can't remember exactly what you said.
Well, he, for example, this is the cosmic doctrine. Mm-hmm. This is a work that was entirely channeled from beginning to end over the course of, oh God, I have it here somewhere, I think 3 years.
Okay.
And no real magical work goes into that. She just empties her mind. She does a channeling technique, really. And mm-hmm. images come, she translates them into words. And it's an entire book full of that. Occultists aren't really generally supposed to do that. There are examples, obviously. But that's an example of a technique that really was not authoritative in any way. Because even Fortune has to admit, I don't know who's giving me this information. I just know the information is coming. And the information is valuable to me, so I'm publishing it. But that's not standard occultist practice. That doesn't even really qualify as magic necessarily. But that's what she based most of her theories on. So that's where she departs from standard magical training.
How would you compare this then to the Book of the Law? Because that was also a channeled work.
Yeah, Crowley, I guess the difference would be that looks more like evoking entities, specific entities that you can see. Technically, Crowley did claim that there was a visible presence in the room. It was a god. That's already something different from just like a communicating entity on the inner planes. But you're right.
With
that is
name.
Another example of, right.
Yeah.
And a message about magic, I guess. Whereas this book, It's fascinating, but it talks about the evolution of the cosmos in a way that in a theoretical system that wasn't anything like the Golden Dawn. So what she was getting through was not magical knowledge. It was something different. So she's always in this kind of uncomfortable space between magic and
right.
channeling and picking up contacts and meeting masters. That were not masters of the Golden Dawn, for example, because the Golden Dawn also had adepts, you know, that didn't have to incarnate, but Fortune's just kind of picking them up out of nowhere, so to speak. Mm-hmm. So that's why certain occultists felt that she was not being critical enough of her sources, and she was just picking up whatever, and there right. was no way to check.
So she wasn't really a proponent of ceremonial magic, ritual magic. It wasn't really important to her.
She was. That was definitely part of what she taught, but that kind of stuff all should be preceded by character training and by careful supervision of the master on the inner plane. So it wasn't a beginner thing. It wasn't something you should start with. And that's why Fortune never revealed any practical details about how to perform rituals, because if you don't even have the proper psychological attitudes towards life in general, mm-hmm. you couldn't do the ritual according to Fortune. So there's this whole process of preparation that precedes everything, which is why Fortune never became known for, oh, pick up a Fortune book because then you can learn how to do rituals.
Right,
no,
right.
All you learn is you cannot do rituals. Don't do rituals. Pick up contacts first.
Right.
And
so
that's why the masters
are so important.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And the reason I think she stressed that so much is I have a quote here from Saint Occultism that I think explains why she felt it was so necessary. I quote here, "The training of the degrees of initiation is designed to teach the mind to rise to the abstract and transcend thought, for it is only when thought ceases that apprehension begins. No one can teach occult science who is not able to draw aside the curtain and reveal the empty shrine, who does not know that the occult doctrines are a system of algebra that enables the mind to function beyond the range of thought. Whoever thinks that the planes and the rays and the hierarchy exist in time and space is not an initiate and therefore cannot be an initiator." So I think Fortune would claim that rituals are too stimulating. When you're performing a magical ritual, you are supposed to believe that the planes and the rays and the hierarchy are real, because that's what you need for the rituals to work. But if you actually believe it, unironically, you're completely going in the wrong direction. Mm. So you need to have all of this preparatory insight to understand that there is a lot of subjective influence coming from your own imagination. So again, Fortune's very careful. So that's why she would never recommend anyone to perform any ritual Crowley was suggesting. Just meditate, pick up contacts, and they will give you all of the steps you need. So there's not a lot you can do, really.
Right. Well, You just mentioned, and then coming back to the thing about the surrendering, and you just mentioned Crowley. I mean, Crowley was talking about an ego death, right? Mm-hmm. In his works. That's how you've explained it to me anyway.
Absolutely.
So what's the difference between Fortune surrendering and Crowley's ego death?
That's a great question. I would have to kind of guess a little bit, because Fortune never presented what happens during your initiatory road after you become accepted by the masters, because then you're on your own path and no one can really tell you what to do. The difference with Crowley is that Crowley did offer like a kind of a map of different spiritual crises, he calls it, the knowledge and conversation of the Holy Guardian Angel, the crossing of the abyss. Fortune doesn't give you any details about that. So she has ideas. A lot of them are included here. So ideas that she channeled, mm-hmm. Quite novel ideas. I guess the difference is that Crowley is, his basic teaching requires technique. You use rituals to stimulate your unconscious. And he describes it very interestingly as you're building up a massive momentum in your unconscious, and that momentum will push your consciousness over the edge, resulting in a huge confrontation with your unconscious in its primal form. But you need to have generated this force within your own soul. So that's why you need to do the practices.
Yeah.
Fortune goes completely the opposite right. route. Like, no, don't do any practices. You need guidance from a master. Crowley also talks about masters, but he never really seems to advise you to contact them channeling wise. You have your holy guardian angel mm-hmm. who will guide you, but Crowley's descriptions of the holy guardian angel and Fortune's description of the masters are completely different.
Yeah.
So
that's what it sounds like.
Yeah.
So Dionne Fortune wrote a lot of books, and she wrote a lot of novels as well. But are there, I mean, she doesn't sound like she was really teaching anything in the sense of magical rituals or any other practices mm-hmm. in specific terms, because that seemed to be very determined by the master of the person who was being or trying to be initiated, I guess you would say. If I'm being very clumsy about this, but so did she try to like put little nuggets of information in the books that people would like glean these subtle messages from the books? Was there any major theme that she was trying to get across, other than the, you know, you have to find your master?
That's an interesting question. when you sent me the questions, I just wrote picking up contacts with the masters, obviously, because that is the major theme. That's an interesting question. I guess she absolutely did drop nuggets. The whole point of her publications seemed to have been that she gives you all the material you need to figure out your own unique kind of practice. So she talks about a lot. If you're in any way interested to read Dionne Fortune's theoretical teachings, because I've been saying a lot, there are no practical teachings, but there are massive amounts of theoretical teaching. And this book in particular, The Mystical Kabbalah, is just, I've read it like 20 times, and every single time I find new stuff, because she talks about so much. I guess it shifts. You know, she, in this book, she doesn't talk about the masters at all, really. So Fortune chooses her subjects very pragmatically. And that also has to do with a shift of her own interest. From the 1930s onwards, for example, she kind of stops talking about Jesus and goes to Druid spirits and roots of Christianity. And rather than seeing Christianity as like the end result of all of these inferior preparations, because that seems to have been her like first kind of point of view. And later on, she starts trans-channeling Druidic spirits from Glastonbury. So, and then she never stops bashing the Catholic Church, as I said, and becomes more open to sexual magic and tantra. So I guess other than a major theme, Fortune is just trying to give you everything, is trying to give you all of the theoretical teachings from like as many different directions as possible from a Western point of view. So I guess that would be a major theme that I would say. She wasn't really all that interested in Eastern methods. She thought theosophy was very valuable, but Westerners have their own magical tradition, and they should not look towards the East for practices that would work for them, because Fortune claimed they would not work. You have no business doing yoga, because that is designed for a different psychic constitution. It's the mystical Kabbalah. That's the Western mystery tradition. And Fortune constantly repeats that it's a tradition that is getting lost. It's in danger of disappearing because people aren't talking about it. Orders like the Golden Dawn haven't done their best in transmitting it. So she's kind of taking it on herself to preserve it and to publish as much as she can about it, so that people will always have a source to go back to and build new practices upon with her own sane occultist touches, using insights from psychology, using insights from science, though she's not as spectacular about that as Crowley, for example. But she seems to have wanted to publish works that could become the theoretical grounding for an endless amount of practical occult revivals from a specifically what she considered to be Western context.
I see. So her books are offering the information for people to do the work for themselves that they need to do. So
theoretically.
Yeah. Okay. The theoretical information. So, pragmatic. That sounds very pragmatic, but it also sounds like, constantly compare it to Crowley, but he was also about, you have to just do the work. Mm-hmm. So there was this practical side of everything that you can't, one person can't be the answer for everyone. You have to do the work yourself. So in that sense, maybe they have something in common, even though their approaches were quite different. So, but in your opinion, what is Fortune's legacy? Does she have a legacy?
Yes.
And what would that be?
She has a very strong loyal readership today. Still, her works are endlessly getting republished. You can find so many of them, like on Amazon. It's quite crazy compared to, I mean, we're talking about someone who wrote in like the 1920s and 30s and 40s. So, other than Aleister Crowley and like Israel Regardi, she's like a giant in that sense. Yeah. Even though Crowley definitely eclipsed her in terms of notoriety. Dion Fortune's books are still, especially again, this one, Mystical Kabbalah, they're good beginner's books, is what everyone constantly says. So that might be interesting for listeners. If you want like a good, sane, not like overly whimsical, and someone who kind of, that's the impression you get from her. That's why I think people read her still nowadays, despite all of the the uncomfortable homophobia and kind of racism. Really, you got to point it out when it's there. She comes across as someone who knows what she's talking about, who has learned from different sources, but has her own opinion. And a lot of her opinions still seem very legitimate in terms of how to psychologically approach spiritual practice in a healthy way, in a sound way. So I totally understand why people keep returning to her works, because they're full and they radiate with an authoritative energy that's very appealing. And that's, even though she doesn't offer any practical suggestions or not that much, she's way easier to read than Aleister Crowley, for example. Crowley is very notorious, but his works are so difficult. And Fortune's very accessible and at the same time gives you a truckload of information. I think that combination is what sets her apart from other writers.
Would you call her no nonsense?
Yeah, if you,
as opposed to like poetry, the poetry of Crowley that he liked to, I mean, there was a lot of artistic flair going on with Crowley.
Yeah.
She seems like she's just more no nonsense. I'm going to tell you this is how it is.
That's how she was known personally as well. No surprise, probably. I guess the only comment I would make to that is she does come across as no nonsense, but then she does talk about Atlantis and root races, and she considers that no nonsense as well. So it's an interesting balancing act.
Yeah, like you
read her like, this woman is, that's why this was the first occultist work I ever read. And I was so impressed because she sounds so smart and intellectual. But then you suddenly get an idea like, Atlantis. And I'm like, wait, what? Like, is she actually serious? But then you'd never know. So it's like,
she is serious.
Yeah.
She wants to take away all of the what I call the airy fairy quality of it. Just to say, this is what it is.
That's definitely, if you're interested in that definitely check out Saint Occultism as well. Okay. Very, very provocative, but fun to read. She's quite humorous, and I totally understand why she still has contemporary readership.
Yeah.
Secondly, she's also one of the major figures to introduce second wave feminism into spiritual literature. That's quite a unique feat. Definitely check out Susan Johnston Graff's article, The Occult Novels of Dion Fortune. So I didn't talk about that here because that's not my specialty, but that's why she will continue to be studied, absolutely. She's also very influential in putting male and female polarity on the map in the occultism. She definitely seems to have been interested in tantra, sexual magic from the 1920s onwards. So that's quite unique for this time period. And I guess what I definitely need to mention is she's a great example of an occultist embracing fiction as a means to educate non-occultist readers about complex expert occultist subjects. So if anyone is interested in that, the Sea Priestess and Moon Magic are classics in the occultist fiction genre, and they are her best, rightly considered to be her best. And especially the latter, Moon Magic, is a great example of Fortune's interest in sexual magic. And Fortune seems to have believed that reading fiction could trigger initiatory events in her readers. So she has written these books from that perspective. So I understand if listeners find that interesting. Her works are written to take you, hopefully, on an initiatory journey. And she isn't just a fiction writer. She is also an occultist. So those works seem to have, I guess if you put it crudely, books like this would be like your theoretical class, and then her fiction would be possibly the moment you have an initiatory experience like she did when she read Alice Bailey. So keep that in mind and check out her, both her fiction and nonfiction seem to form this composite whole that maybe her fiction fills some gaps that people have felt very present in her nonfiction. So Fortune will definitely be on the radar of scholars because of that unique approach to fiction.
Right. Well, of course, it's impossible in the span of an hour to explain everything about it sounds like a very enigmatic character, very determined, focused, opinionated person. Also a little dramatic, but also very pragmatic. And so, a lot of stuff going on. So it's very difficult, to condense everything into an hour. But I appreciate and thank you for coming to share, what you've found about Dion Fortune in the time that you've been researching her and what you've been learning about her. And I really appreciate that. I hope the viewers also have enjoyed this. So I thank you for that. If people have questions, how can they contact you?
Well, you can always just leave a comment.
Sure.
I'd love that. I have replied to comments before on the videos. I love that. You can also, if you're not comfortable sending putting it on public display like that, you can send me an email, thomas.vambreda@outlook.com. I have, like Stephanie said, I've written a research master's thesis on her. I can send you the Dion Fortune chapter that basically contains everything I've talked about, but in more detail with references. If you are interested in that, you can always send me an email. I don't really use social media that much. I'm on academia.edu, but there's nothing on it. So you can follow me, but probably won't be as useful as just dropping a comment. So, but please do. I'd love to read some of your thoughts.
That would be wonderful if we can facilitate that contact between viewers and yourself. Do you have anything that you're working on at the moment?
I am trying to prepare for a PhD project. So
great.
Fortune will hopefully appear in that. If all goes well, it's going to tap into that pragmatic enigma that I've been obsessed with. How serious how seriously do occultists want us to take them when they talk about, like I said, the planes and the rays and the energies, when they themselves admit on the following page, sometimes on the same page, that you shouldn't believe in that. Right. But then, like, what is that? When did it appear? What are the intellectual sources of that? Because, you know, pragmatism is a philosophical tradition as well, appearing at the kind of the same time as Fortune and Crowley. So I'm very interested in that. So, yeah, I'm just going to keep on going with what I've been studying. And yeah.
Good.
I've been working on an article as well, but I find it's just way too much. So I'm just going to focus on putting it in a PhD project, right, hopefully.
Okay. Well, best of luck to you with all of that. And thank you again for coming to talk about Dion Fortune. And thank you for the comment of the listener of the podcast who asked the question. I will go back and look for the name. I don't have the name at hand, but I'll put that in the description box to thank that person directly for the inspiration for this interview. So thank you again. And thank you to the viewers for watching, and I hope you'll join me next time. Thank you.